Hello and welcome to Anthropology on Air, a podcast brought to you by the Social Anthropology Department at the University of Bergen in Norway. Each season, we bring you conversations with inspiring thinkers who are either based at our department or who have come to share their research with us. In this special episode of Anthropology on Air, we speak with Thomas Salem, a PhD fellow in our own Department of Social Anthropology here at the University of Bergen. We do a deep dive on some of the themes covered in Thomas's first book, Policing the Favelas in Rio de Janeiro, Cosmologies of War and the Far Right, which is released this week. Based on fieldwork Thomas conducted in 2015 when he was a master's student here, the book explores the links between militarized policing and far-right ideologies. We talk about the social and political conditions that preceded the rise of the man who became the president of Brazil, Jair Bolsonaro, forms of everyday violence in the favelas of Rio, masculinity and hierarchy in the police force, doing ethnography with those you might disagree with, and how Thomas's thoughts about the political and analytical value of anthropology have evolved in the years since he carried out the original research. We hope you enjoy the conversation. It is my great pleasure to welcome friend and colleague Thomas Salem to the studio. And I wanted to ask you, Thomas, can you start by telling us about your book? What does it cover and what was the time period you were working in?
Yes, of course. Thank you, Sadie. Thank you for having me here. So my book is a monograph about the military police in Rio de Janeiro. I did field work with the police from December 2014 to July 2015. This was part of my master thesis here in Bergen. And I've kept working with the police in Brazil since then. And when I did field work, it was a moment of contestation over the future of Brazil and a lot of political turmoil, an economic downturn, a restructuring of the local economy, and also a process of urban transformation in preparation for the 2016 Olympics. So it was a particular moment in Brazilian history. I went down there to do research with the police. I wasn't really sure of whether I would be able to get access or not, but I thought I'll just have to see when I arrive what the possibilities are. And I ended up doing my fieldwork in three different police stations that had been established in three different favelas. This was part of a larger urban security intervention ahead of the Olympics. Rio de Janeiro is a city that has been known for its high levels of armed violence. You have favelas that are low-income community, low-income self-organized communities where state presence has been variable and where you've had drug gangs establish themselves and using the favelas as a site for the sale of drugs. And these gangs have been territorially based, so they've kind of worked as small chiefdoms in the favela. So there's been a lot of conflict both between different gangs, but also between the police and the gangs. But these relations are far from easy to grasp, because sometimes the gangs are in opposition with the police, sometimes they collude with the police, and the same goes for the police as well. They entertain different kinds of relations with the gangs and different kinds of relations with other armed groups, mainly paramilitary groups. which have also taken control of some favelas and some urban, larger urban areas. These paramilitary groups, they started perhaps as vigilante groups, and then their logic became much more commercial. So it's a city where you have a multiplicity of armed agents vying for power, but also collaborating with each other. This sometimes creates a lot of armed violence on the streets of the city, apart from the favelas, which are kind of like, they're kind of like hidden from view for a large part of the city's residents, and especially from the tourists, even if they are very visible wherever you are in Rio, because they're often located up on the hillsides of the city. And as the city was preparing to host the Olympics, there were concerns about the security situation during the Olympics. So the police stations that I worked at, they had been established in response to those concerns, as a show of force that the state was finally present in the favelas, that Brazil was a country that was modernizing, that was leaving its past behind. And the authorities in Rio, they called this the pacification project. And the police stations were called pacifying police units. So this was the project that I went to study. And during my fieldwork, I spent most of my time in the favelas. I lived in one quote-unquote pacified favela in the south area of the city. And I did fieldwork in several other favelas. In the favela where I lived, I avoided being seen with the police, or I avoided any kind of contact with the police because this conflict situation. And then I worked mainly in three other favelas where I followed the police officers that were on duty. So I spent a lot of times at the police stations. I spent some time out patrolling with the police officers. And I spent some time getting to know the city and participating or assisting public debates and interviewing high-level police officers or local politicians, local researchers. So it was a fieldwork that had several dimensions to it. But the main part of my fieldwork I spent in a favela that's called Alemão. It's part of a larger favela complex called Complexo de Alemão. And what characterized that favela was that it had been the former stronghold of the main drug cartel in Rio, Comando Vermelho. And it was in many ways the front line of the state's war on drugs and the front line of the pacification project. So it was an area that, in the eyes of the police that I worked with, but also in the eyes of many Cariocas, in many Rio's inhabitants, was a war zone. And while I was doing my fieldwork there, I started understanding the situation in the city more as a war than as a situation where I was studying some regular kind of policing, right? And they were the police officers that I followed, they were engaged in daily shootouts, and some of these shootouts would last for hours, in some occasions even for days. And the stories that the police officers told me, they were not similar to anything that we would associate with normal police work. And the police officers also made frequent comparisons to other war zones in the Middle East in particular. So In Rio, there's been tradition within the academic scholarship to analyze the way that people talk about the conflicts in Rio as a war, as a metaphor. So they've been talking about what this metaphor of war does. And in the book, I've taken it a step further and thought about it as an actual war. So not just as a metaphor, but also challenging this distinction between war as something actually real and war as a way to understand social conflicts and social dynamics. So the subtitle of my book, Cosmologies of War, refers to that aspect of it. And another thing that I saw while I was doing my fieldwork was that among the police officers and the families of the police officers, there was a very strong authoritarian sentiment, a strong rejection of democracy and democratic values, a strong call for a more severe and aggressive security policy. And these claims, these police claims, they later became central to the claims of the Brazilian far-right movement. And among the police officers, I heard throughout my fieldwork references to Jair Bolsonaro and his sons, who are also politicians. And of course, I became familiar with Bolsonaro. He was very much a little bit of a fringe figure, even if he was one of the most voted deputies from the state of Rio. And so he was very popular in Rio, but still that represented a few percent of the total vote count in the country. Mm. And he seemed at the moment to be far too radical to get like a broader public support. So he wasn't really taken seriously by anyone, you know, except for these limited groups, you know, where he had a lot of support, such as the police and the military. Mm. And after I left Rio, he ended up winning the 2018 presidential election, and he became the president of Brazil at the beginning of 2019. And all these opinions, values, and understandings of the mm-hmm. of the world and of politics that I'd seen while I was doing field work with the police suddenly became commonplace. So the book is an attempt to understand what Bolsonaro's government represented through the field work that I did with the police. And I think that it also has relevance to try to understand other contexts where the far right has been emerging, because there's a lot of shared ideological baggage between far right movements in Brazil and elsewhere. So you could say that it's an attempt to theorize the link between the police and the far right in Brazil, hopefully with some broader applicability.
Yeah, you've alluded to it there, but I wondered if you could talk a bit more about, like, what were these seeds of far-right ideology or machinations that you saw among your informants or interlocutors?
Well, the main argument that I make in the book is that one of the characteristics of the far-right movement in Brazil is this understanding of social relations through the optics of warfare. So they would normally talk about the war as a war against crime and a war against drugs. But it could also be seen as a kind of cultural war, where there was a lot of debate about gender roles, and potentially as a spiritual war as well. Bolsonaro had a broad support from the evangelical churches in Brazil, not all of them, but many of them, and especially the more politicized evangelical churches. So I look at how Pentecostal cosmology shaped the far-right project. And in the Pentecostal churches, there is this understanding of existence as a spiritual battle between the forces of good and the forces of evil. So it's God against the devil, and we see this in Bolsonaro's rhetoric very clearly. He consistently talks about God and the homeland. So that's a very important part, this religious dimension, but also with regards to the cultural dimension, I've already talked about gender roles and the far right's attempt to reinstitute traditional gender roles or hierarchies. In this area, we could have an interesting discussion, because this is one area where I think that current critical theory is in need of some reinvention. But also in Cold War imaginaries of a fight against communism and a fight against the left. So there is a historical continuity in the far right project in Brazil that can be traced back to colonial times. And I also use the notion of colonial warfare as an analytical category to understand what is going on and what has gone on, both in this policing project, but also in during Bolsonaro's government. But I refer to colonial warfare mainly in its material dimension and mainly as an analytical category. That's not the way that the people that I talked with thought about the war. But the conflict is very much racialized, and it's very much a conflict with an important economic dimension. And that's the sense in which I use this notion of colonial war. What's curious in Brazil is that a lot of the police officers that worked in the favelas, they were not so different from the people that they were set to patrol or control. So there are many black Brazilians, black persons serving in the military and military police in Rio, and there are many people from low-income communities, including favelas. And the way that they differentiated themselves from the people that they were patrolling was by references to the cultural difference. So they were different because they had respect for authority and because they cultivated this ethos of individual responsibility that's also tied to the evangelical movement, but it's also tied to neoliberal politics and ideologies. And they perceived the people that lived in the favelas as culturally different, as adhering to the culture of trafficking, and as somehow being to blame for their conditions. So they talked about people that were living in the favelas as morally inferior, and they saw their poverty and and struggle as a sign of their moral shortcomings.
It might be helpful at this point just to paint a picture of the favelas. So how are favelas different to low-income neighborhoods in Rio, for example? And what do they look like? How are they imagined? I think many people will have an idea of what favelas are, but on the ground in the city, how is the distinction made?
Yeah, that's a very good question. So depending on where you are in Rio, the difference between a favela and the formal city, as it's called, the asphalt, is very visible. So you can see it in the architecture, where the favela architecture is much more organic. And this is because most of the homes in the favelas have either been self-built or they have adopted like the kind of urban sprawl that's characteristic of more organic urban forms of urbanization, while the rest of the city, like the wealthy parts of the city, have been designed and planned and often according to this modern ideal of what a city should look like, right? So actually many favelas can be very reminiscent of old city centers, either in European cities or I haven't been everywhere, but like I remember when I went to Morocco, it's also this kind of a lot of alleys and that crisscross and no straight streets. And so in some parts of the city, it's very easy to see the difference. In other parts of the city where the favelas are surrounded by low income neighborhoods, it's not so easy to see where the favela starts and where the asfalto begins. The historical difference is that the favelas were self-organized communities originally, so they were squats actually, and often the people who live in the favelas, they don't have papers, like they don't have property rights because it's land that has been squatted. This has changed with time. A lot of favela residents have acquired property rights. But they've been communities characterized by informality, and they've been self-organized. So they've gotten together with neighbors to build a sewage system, to get electricity, to provide the services that are needed, water, etc. The many favelas have been through a long process of urbanization, so that this doesn't always apply. And from the 80s, from the return of democracy in Brazil, from the end of the military civil rule in 1985, one of the defining features of the favelas has been this vying of control by different armed groups. And symbolically, the favelas have always been seen as threatening, either due to sanitary or health issues or due to stigmatization of poverty. But since these gangs started controlling the favelas, due to the fear of the crime that was seen as located within the favela and the fear that this would spill out into the rest of the city. Actually, the favelas, to the people who live there, have often felt very safe because the gangs that have controlled them have enforced their own rules and laws. And there has been little crime in the favelas. And the danger has mainly been associated with police invasions. So that's for many people who live in the favelas, the police are actually perceived as more of a threat than the drug gangs. But this is not always the case either. So I think if you want to understand the favelas, you have to contemplate the complexity and the difference between different favelas and different historical moments and a lot of personal dynamics that influence how favelas can be thought of as different from the asfalto. But perhaps the one defining, overarching factor is stigmatization. So the favelas have been, and the populations there are heavily stigmatized, and there are a lot of racial dynamics in play there as well.
Mention police violence against the people in the favelas and how this is talked about as a war. But something you also mention, which I think is very interesting, is this hierarchy of institutionalized violence, like intra-police violence within the force, within the hierarchy. And I wondered what kind of effect that presence or expectation of violence, both within and without, has on the people you worked with, and perhaps there's a gendered component to that, or a version of masculinity that is being enacted and enforced here. But you can take them as separate questions.
Yeah, definitely. So one of the things, I can start with masculinity perhaps, because that's one of the themes or the one of the categories of analysis that I've worked with the most. And I've been particularly interested in understanding how a certain symbolic understanding of manhood as something violent has been pervasive in the police. And this is something that has been written quite extensively about. And I've been interested in how these notions of manhood hampered attempts to reform the police and transform it into a more democratic, citizen-oriented police force. These notions of manhood have sometimes been attributed to the armed conflict in the favelas. I think that's wrong. I think that's kind of like locating the problem again in the favelas and in the poor community. So that's where the violence originates. Actually, when you look at Brazilian history, you see that this very aggressive notion of manhood has been cultivated in the military. So it's a militarized masculinity. And one could easily assume that the dissemination of this militarized masculinity in other areas, for example, in the drug gangs, has is very connected to the way that these communities have been policed historically. And you can go back in colonial history and analyze the relationship between church and military and private enterprise and see that there's been a connection there from the onset of colonization. So the big landowners in the colonial period of Brazil, they often had military rank. They were slaveholders, and they enforced their power with violence. So it's definitely a thing, this militarization of manhood. But I think that when we're talking about the far right, and if we want to understand like far right masculinity, it's not enough, you know. And I think that that's one of the areas where we're seeing a lot of reaction, because especially in later years, there's been like this, a lot of talk about toxic masculinity, right? And I think that many men have felt attacked. I think that there's a lot of talk now, not just on the far right, but it's becoming more and more generalized about, yeah, okay, so what is the role of men then, you know? And we've had this feminist movement that comes from thousands of years of oppression, and that is totally justified, and that we've needed this critique. But in this process, it has become unclear what the role of the man is, you know, and there are a lot of men that are no longer sure what their value is, and I think that animates a lot of these far right movements, this sensation of not having necessarily any value anymore among men. And I think that in the case of the police, one of the ways to affirm your value as a man is through violence. I'm not saying that these men are victims, but I think that it's important to understand these dynamics and understand how they affect notions of manhood, not just the military, but also the critique of manhood, you know? Mm. And that's something where I'm still like trying to grapple with how can we understand masculinity within this context, right? Because I come from a critical tradition, and I've written a lot about this quote-unquote toxic masculinity. I've written about violent masculinity, but it's very similar, you know. These men, sometimes they get into the police because they want to mm-hmm. own a gun, and because they want to exercise that kind of authority. Mm-hmm. And that was very explicit among the police officers that I interviewed. I asked one officer what motivated police officers to join the force, and he said, money, guns, and was it cars or women? It was either of the two. You'll have to read the book.
Interchangeable.
Yeah. But it was, for many, it was about power. But I also think that a lot of police officers wanted to, when they joined the force, they wanted to make a change. They wanted to contribute to a better society. They wanted to be protectors. And when they entered the police force, they were subject to a process of, they were subject to a process of subjective transformation. They underwent a social formation process that was often very violent.
Yeah.
Since the military police is a military institution, it's shaped by military hierarchy and a military and a disciplinary code of conduct that is very strict and that has some rules that seem quite absurd, especially in a if we're thinking in a democratic modern society, which Brazil in many cases very much is, in other cases it's not. And the police officers had to be brutalized in order to become aggressive, you know. It is in that sense, that's one of the ways in which I talk about institutional violence, the way that low-ranking police officers were treated within the police institution. They, many of them have reported being subject to torture or other forms of violence by their superiors. They felt very unprotected. They felt that they could be punished at any moment for anything, because the disciplinary codes gave so much power to their superiors. And they also felt that they were used as scapegoats, because they were very much made aware of that their role was to kill criminals in the favelas. But then if something went wrong, or if this garnered too much public attention, or if they were caught like acting outside of the law, then the low-ranking officers would have to take the blame. And their superiors would explain this as a case of police misconduct. Which of course it was a case of police misconduct, but it is part of an institutional culture, you know. And the higher ups, they hardly ever had to, they were hardly ever made responsible for these kind of actions or for this kind of police misconduct, even if it was systematic throughout the institution. On the other hand, the police officers at the pacifying police units, they were supposed to be kind of diplomats in the favelas, and they were supposed to be in dialogue with the local populations there. But they encountered a lot of armed resistance from the gangs as well. So they felt that they were in a very vulnerable position where they had to defend themselves. And this was real violence. The first time I was at the police station in Alemão, I came into the station and there was a guy mopping blood off the floor, and a police officer had been shot in the face inside the police station. The police station was full of bullet holes. If the police killed a gang member in a shootout, then they had to prepare for retaliation. That also happened while I was there one time. The police had killed a young man who was probably part of a gang member. He had shot at the police. Sometimes they kill people who you really wonder if they are in fact part of a gang member or not, and sometimes these killings are more executions than acts of self-defense most of the times. But in this case, there had been a shootout and we were at the police station and we had to put on bulletproof vests inside the police station because they could expect retaliation. So this, of course, affected the psyche, the mental health of the police officers. So most of the police officers at the pacifying police units, or at least a high percentage of them, were, according to this, the staff psychologists that I interviewed, could be considered sick or with severe mental health issues,
yeah,
and addiction issues, and yeah, the whole range of different problems. So those were the kind of those were the forms of main forms of violence that the police officers experienced.
Mm. Something I'm wondering is, one way of understanding masculinity is, or masculinities, is as a set of practices or behaviors that are accessible in theory to anyone. And I wondered if you had, like, I imagine it's mainly men in these roles, but did you meet women or queer people or people of different identities, let's say, other than heterosexual men, who were also enacting these masculine forms of violence?
Yes. So I didn't meet queer people within the police because it's a very homophobic institution. And I'm gay myself, so I wasn't open about that when I was doing fieldwork because I feared that either they would not want to talk to me because they would reject me, or they would not want to talk to me because they would fear getting rejected by their colleagues. So I was private about my sexual identity, or sexuality. I don't know if we should use identity. Like, I'm struggling with this identity politics. But there were women that served as police officers, and that was part of the gender politics of the institution as well, because they wanted to give the police a softer face. Most of the women that served in the police, they were given administrative chores. Mm. But some women also patrolled on the street, and some women adopted this very aggressive masculine performance.
Mm.
I'm starting to I think some of the critique from the right in this way of thinking about gender as pertaining to an individual identity, that's in which is associated with this notion of identity politics, is that it leaves both men and women, it kind of forces both men and women to adopt a certain gendered expression to gain power. And it doesn't acknowledge, perhaps, other forms of power that can be considered either feminine or representative of the other notions of manhood. So there's a lot more attention to care, for example, and the practice of care as a way to exercise power as well, and as a part of the notion of power. And care can both be considered feminine gendered expression, but it can also be a masculine masculine expression in the role of the protector, you know. So I think that this is an area where there's probably going to be a lot of interesting developments in how we think about gender in the years to come, I think. And I think that some of the critique from towards identity politics is worth taking into consideration. I might be stirring the pot when I say this. But that's one of the areas that I'm, yeah, that I'm excited about, like trying to think this in a new way, you know, and think about, like, not necessarily because we need to adopt this view, because there are different understandings of gender at play here that are in opposition. And if we want to understand this strong rejection of identity politics and of feminism, then we need to understand how gender is differently conceived. And I don't think it's sufficient to say that these are people who want to reinstate traditional gender hierarchies. It's part of that, yes, but there's more. And I think that the notion of complementarity is very useful. And I think that we need to think about, like, gender in the context of the family as well, and kinship. So maybe going back to those categories, then we can start to untangle a little bit of the conflict that we're seeing now in the field of gender and this attack on the so-called gender ideology.
That's very interesting, and gets me onto my next question, which is about what it was like for you to spend time with people whose views you maybe strongly disagree with, or initially maybe even find abhorrent. This is a book about the far right and far right ideology in Brazil.
And I'm a radical anarchist.
What was it like to put this anarchist cat among the far right pigeons?
It was humbling, and it was very, for me, it was great, because it made me learn how to shut up and listen. And it really forced me to consider other points of view. It's easy to do. I don't know if it's easy, but I think when you agree with the people that you're doing research with, and you have a lot of sympathy for them, then you don't have a lot of the dilemmas that I think are part of field work. And, like, yeah, I actually think that we're encountering these dilemmas all the time, right? I don't know if I want to frame this as so radically different from what anthropologists have been doing all the time. You know, we have been meeting people and studying with people whose worldviews are often radically opposed to our own, you know. And I think that this has been a constant in anthropology, and I think that's probably, humbling experience for many anthropologists, not just those who study far-right subjectivities. But I think that in the last decades, with the post-colonial critique of our discipline, we've been wanting to research people that we can align with politically. And we've been wanting anthropology to contribute to this struggle for emancipation. And that has created a particular kind of subject that we do research with. And now we're suddenly seeing that these traditional, quote-unquote, ethnographic subjects are perhaps we don't always disagree with them, and then that becomes a problem, because we've turned anthropology into this political project. And I think it's useful to really reflect on the distinction between political anthropology and analytical anthropology, and sometimes maybe you can do analytical work without taking a clear stance at the moment of research. And or at least suspend like this passing of judgment, you know, and really try to take the other person seriously, which I think is a goal for most anthropologists. And now there's a debate about this, and when with regards to the emergence of the far right, you know, because it's the far right has a lot of support among the groups of people that have been marginalized and that we have been used to studying with. And suddenly we realize that, yeah, maybe they think differently than us. And how do we position ourselves in those cases? And I don't have any clear answer to that. I've tried to represent the police officers as complex human beings that have a lot of that face a lot of moral dilemmas of their own, and that reflect on their own role and position, and can be ambivalent towards it as well, but also as sovereign agents that take decisions that I don't agree with morally as well, and that are very problematic because a lot of them are perpetrators. What is increasingly being referred to as a genocide against Black people and culture in Brazil. So it's a very, I've tried to highlight the complexity, and I've tried to humanize the police officers so that they don't figure as monsters. But without legitimizing what they are doing as part of a very violent institution, right?
My final question is, this was based on master's fieldwork that you did in 2015, I think you said. And you have said that if you wrote the book today, you might write particular parts differently. Can you say why?
Yeah, well, it has to do with what we've just been talking about. But I said that the other day at the book launch, and then I thought, yeah, maybe. I'm not sure. I'm not sure about any of these things, you know. I go a lot back and forth. I think that it comes across very clearly in the book what my own political position is. I tried to make it as explicit as possible. It's a self-reflexive style of writing, so I let the reader know what I was thinking when I saw certain events, and I make it clear that this was my reaction from my point of view, coming from Argentina, having grown up in Norway, and having certain expectations about Brazilian society as well. And sometimes I feel that I fall in this trap of describing police officers a little bit like monsters. And sometimes I worry that I might become like morally relativistic, excessively relativistic, and and that's a tension within the text. And I don't have an answer to the how this can be done in the best way. I think it's interesting that there's a tension there as well, and I think that hopefully can spur some debate. So when I made that comment, that was what I was thinking about. And especially I think that I would have been more nuanced when I was writing about gender and masculinity. I'm looking forward to see where that debate develops in the coming years. I think there's still a lot more to do there. I don't think we're finished with that.
No.
Yeah.
Well, you've really made a very interesting contribution. And I too will follow this debate with interest. But thank you so much for coming on, Thomas.
Thank you, Sadie.
You've been listening to Anthropology on Air, a project of the Social Anthropology Department at the University of Bergen. The music in the podcast was made by Victor Lange, and the episode was produced by Sadie Hale and Sissel Marie Henriksen. If you like what you've heard, why not subscribe or leave us a review? We'd love to hear from you. You can follow us on Facebook and by visiting uib.no/antro, where you will also find more information on the ongoing work and upcoming events at the department. Until next time, from our city between the Fjell, take care and harde bra.